The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Hello, I'm your host, Beverly Prentice, and you're listening to Beyond, an hour-long program of science fiction, fantasy, myth, and adventure. If you enjoy the program, please drop a line to beyond3x5@gmail.com. Thank you. The Borderlands by Carol Brown. I caught the zombie weeping in the middle aisle between breakfast cereals and cookies, staring at an empty patch of moonlit wall near the ceiling. The broom rested lightly in his hands, cradled in his dead fingers, with its bristles still flared at the bottom, as though he had stopped his sweeping in mid-stroke. That lack of sound, the sudden hush, had drawn me down the stairs, as someone who lived by the sea would have been surprised one night if the waves had suddenly stopped their gentle shushing and broken in silence on the sand. I had stopped my silent pacing in the hall above this door, an art that I had mastered out of necessity and long practice. I spaced my footfalls carefully to thread the maze of loose boards that would wake Gwen, tell her instantly that I was out of bed again. If she found me here, she would yell, plead, sulk in silence, coerce me to return to bed, to sleep, to the visions that still came every night and that I still could not bear. So, at night, I walked, measuring over and over the corridor that ran the length of the building, from one end of the apartment to the top of the stairs that led to the store below, until I collapsed from sheer exhaustion into utter darkness, too tired to dream. Until the night the broom stopped. Albert? I didn't realize at first that he was weeping. I'd never heard of such a thing. And what could make a dead man weep? My first thought as I came down the stairs, seeing him motionless and striped with light and shadow falling through the shuttered window, was that something was wrong, that perhaps he had simply shut down, as sometimes they did, falling over in their tracks at their employer's feet, dropping their garden tools or the packages they were carrying. Uncommon as such incidents were, it was the possibility of them that had kept from the zombies the right to drive. But Albert was still standing, and it wasn't until I stepped closer that I saw the trails, silver ribbons in the moonlight that ran down his cheeks. Albert, are you all right? His jaw hung slack, his shoulders slumped, and his gaze never wavered from that spot high on the wall. I followed it with my own eyes, straining to see what he was seeing. But whatever he watched was visible only to a zombie's eyes. I touched him lightly on the shoulder. I had never touched a zombie before, never had to handle Albert in the year that he'd been working for me. The flesh of his arm was unnaturally soft and pliant, like dough, and I shuddered. Albert, I said a little more harshly. After a long moment, he lowered his gaze, turning toward me, and for a brief instant, I thought I saw something there, a fire in the emptiness, a spark of life. But that wasn't possible. And he turned away from me, shuffling off down the aisle of the store, filled again with the soft rasping of straw on linoleum. In retrospect, it feels like it was that moment when the thought first entered my mind. It's not possible, of course. I didn't yet know what I later learned, hadn't yet discovered what Albert saw, what was to be seen through the eyes of the dead. But perhaps some premonition, some shiver of a guess, had already set my mind in motion. And I noticed as Albert walked away from me that he had not stopped weeping. Life has a way of pushing you in directions you never intended to go. of carrying you in its currents to whatever eddy or tide pool it chooses to deposit you. We had certainly never intended to own a corner grocery, my wife Gwendolyn and I. That was too normal for us, so damnably normal that I used to wake at night with knives in my stomach. The small but potent daggers of regret, cowardice, self-loathing. We had wanted adventure, high times and glamour. Unfortunately, we were both dogged by an equally strong streak of reasonableness, a prudence that belied our years. When I finished school, working my way through as a stocker and then assistant manager at Brock's Groceries, we made plans to escape the city, settle someplace where adventure lurked around the corner, though you could still come home to a soft bed and a warm house at the end of the day. Colorado, maybe, or Idaho. Depressions have a way of changing plans. When the time came, we just couldn't justify packing up for parts unknown without a job waiting, not in the state the country was in. The odds were against finding anything, and we had neither the savings to wait it out nor the passion to risk starvation. In the end, we settled. I stayed on at Brock's and Gwen at Swanson's department store, and we kept telling ourselves that one day we would just do it. Just pack up and go. But right now, we still owed on the car and couldn't afford to make the payments and insurance without a steady income. As soon as that was paid off, we'd head east to the mountains. Then came the furniture payments and the credit card bills we'd tracked up. We bought Brock's the year I turned 30. We'd thought long and hard, but in the end, couldn't pass up the security. Old man Brock offered it to me at a special price, seeing as how I'd been there 13 years and basically running it the last 5. The bank considered me stable and gave me the loan, and that was that. Roots, foundations, we were stuck. Then we told ourselves that we'd take great vacations, but we could never afford much help, and with both of us working full-time, and then some at the store, it was impossible for us both to be off at the same time. Someday, we told each other, one of these days we'll hire some more help, promote Bobby to assistant manager, let him run the day-to-day, and then we'll be free to go wherever we want someday. So, of course, when they began offering zombies, we snatched one right away. Albert, the zombie turned toward Dr. Spar, who checked a box on his clipboard and gave a nod that transformed into a shake of his head. I don't know what to tell you, Mr. Richards. In every test that I can run here, Albert checks out just fine. Motor control, homeostatic functions, sensory response, everything seems fine. I don't know what's wrong. Albert faced front again, his eyes unblinking and locked on the wall as if he were supremely interested in the 6 food groups as delineated by the FDA's poster. In fact, he probably couldn't even see the poster through his tears. Albert wept almost constantly now. It was why I had brought him to a doctor. The second night, I found him standing in the middle of the store, gazing up at nothing with overflowing eyes. I began to worry. After the first incident, I had made a perfunctory search for any information on weeping zombies, assuming it to be a rare but explicable phenomenon with highly technical causes, perhaps even something involuntary. I had been surprised to find absolutely nothing. Nothing in the local libraries, nothing in the free access databases, no rumors among friends and acquaintances of anything of the sort that I had seen. Perhaps, I thought, it was just an anomaly. 2 nights later, I found him again in his state of, what, despair? Can a zombie feel despair or any emotion? I had thought not. Thought that had been a motivating factor behind the drive to hire them. They worked steadily, unemotionally, reliably, almost like robots in those stories. Not that anyone would mistreat them for it. After all, they were still people, just of a different sort. They had families, their living kin. They had everything the living had, except for one thing. They had no mind. A week after the first incident, Albert came in weeping, and nothing would make him stop. He still worked. He just wept while he did it. I thought it best to bring him for a checkup. The trouble is, Dr. Sparr was saying, we just don't know enough about the brain still, or about zombies. In many respects, they're like coma patients. Certain involuntary systems continue to function, even though there's no EEG activity. But obviously, they're more than that. The zombies have consciousness of a sort. They see, hear, touch, feel, but do they think? Do they experience emotion? Is this sadness? He touched Albert's damp cheek. Or is this watering eyes? It would be helpful if they would speak to us, tell us what they're experiencing. Sometimes it's like treating an infant. Would speak? I assume they couldn't talk, I said. Dr. Sparr just shrugged. They don't, but not for any physical reasons. Not most of them, anyway. Another one of the unanswered questions about zombies. He smiled at me and shrugged again. Gave Albert a pat on the shoulder. He didn't know, didn't particularly care. Nobody particularly cared about the dead, unless it was one of theirs. Karen was born on the 4th of July, so that later I would tell her the whole country celebrated her birthday. Gwen, exhausted after 37 hours of labor, collapsed into a well-deserved sleep, and I sat with our daughter for a long time, until the doctors told me to put her down and leave her be, go home for the night and get some sleep myself. Instead, I lit sparklers and fireworks and danced through the streets like a madman. She was the type of child that everyone, not just grandparents, calls an angel, which meant she mostly took after Gwen. Physically, she was my wife in miniature, with the same small nose, the widely spaced green eyes, the hair just one brown tone shy of blonde, and her smile, the mischievous cocked head grin. Inside, she was Daddy's little girl, and she clung to me and followed me around the store as soon as she could move, first at a crawl and later in that perpetual run, half a step ahead of a fall forward of the two-year-old. For a time, I carried her in a rucksack on my back as I worked around the store, fearful of mischance and mischief, humming songs to her and feeling her small, warm breath on my neck. Gwen told me I looked like a Bolivian housewife, and besides, the child would never learn to walk if her feet never touched the ground. I gave in and turned her loose. For months, I still thought I felt her breath on my neck and would smile. Fortunately, the zombies had already begun appearing by that time, had been around long enough to have entered the workforce. Mitchell, Albert's predecessor, as general helper at the store, had been left as Bobby's sole help in the days we were gone, the almost 2 days of labor, of Gwen screaming with the delights of natural childbirth, and me hovering and pacing and chain-smoking the celebratory cigars I had bought. By all accounts, they managed things quite well, to our pleasant surprise. Even more surprising, as we discovered when Gwen returned to work and brought our daughter with her, Mitchell was good with children. He handled Karen like a flower, hovering protectively nearby whenever we let her play on the floor in front of the cash register. And though initially images of Boris Karloff as Frankenstein's monster crowded my mind, so that I vowed never to let the two of them near Daisy's or Wells, Mitchell never raised a finger against her, never even bumped her accidentally. I'd learned later he'd had two daughters in life, both of whom he'd survived. Something is happening in their brains. It's not raw pulp. I'm convinced of that. They tell us, for those who care, that they lack higher brain functions, that the brain stem and cerebellum still function for the most part, but the cerebrum and cortex are almost functionless. They have no memories, no real thought, just baseline comprehension and reaction. But Mitchell remembered his daughters and saw in mine a reflection of them. I knew that look in his eye, recognize it in hindsight. I see it in the morning when I look in the mirror, written with the dark circles of sleeplessness, loss, longing, and delicate shades of madness. And now I know why Albert weeps. I drove him out to the small tract house that was his family's home, a cute little box of a place, identical to the rows upon rows of cute little boxes that surrounded it, all of which had sprung up in the 40s and 50s, in the explosion of returning vets. They were old now and starting to collapse, the ones not kept up. But it said something to me that slapped together houses of 50 years past looked better than quality-built homes erected 10 years ago. They didn't have a porch, just a concrete stoop that jutted out from the front door. Barbara Ann Davison sat on it, a beer in one hand and a cigarette in the other, talking with her husband Bill and a neighbor. I could hear her laughter as I drove up. The neighbor glared darkly at me, muttering something to Barb and scurrying off as I opened the door for Albert. "Hi, Mr. Richards." Barb nodded as we walked up. "Hello, Dad." I noticed she had to take a swig of beer before the second greeting. Albert didn't acknowledge her, simply stepped past her and into the house beyond. She flinched as his arm brushed her shoulder. "What brings you out here to the suburbs, Mr. Richards?" Bill's voice boomed in false conviviality. "Well, I wanted to bring his paycheck by." "Could have mailed it as usual," Barb said, "and talk to you about something." "Dad?" I nodded. For a long moment, I wasn't sure what she might do. She stared at the cracked cement, the cigarette dangling between her fingers, and the smoke rising in chaotic swirls. After a long while, she sighed. "Bill, go in and make sure Dad's okay, will you?" Bill nodded and patted his wife on the shoulder, following the zombie inside. We all knew zombies didn't need looking after. I waited until Bill was well gone. "You've noticed it, too?" "The crying? Yeah, I've noticed it." "What is it?" She shook her head, refusing to look at me, staring off down the street of houses that seemed to reflect away in both directions infinitely, like two mirrors held facing each other. "What do you think it is?" "No idea," she said. She gave a harsh, barking laugh. "Dad never was what you'd call a real happy person, even when he was alive." She lapsed again into silence. "There's something you're not telling me," I said. "Just thinking how to say it," she answered. "All these zombies and stuff, it's real hard to talk about." "Oh, I expect I don't have much problem. He's just a guy that comes and works for you, stays with you 5 days a week. Good worker once you get used to the sight of ligaments and muscles and stuff hanging out of him. But that happens pretty quickly, doesn't it? He's just an employee. You ever had one of those and yours come back? Just when I get used to the idea that him and Mom are gone for good, and not just in Florida until May. Just when I can say they're dead without breaking up, he shows up." She looked away again. Her eyes were dry, but a deep flush colored her cheeks, and her voice skipped along in breaths. "Like that, all gross. It still scares me to look at him. He doesn't talk, doesn't hold me close, just sits there staring. But what can I do? He's my dad. I'm sorry. It's pathetic and useless, and it's all I can say." She was right. I didn't know what it was like. Part of me wanted to ask her, "Isn't it better that he's here at all? He's still your dad, and aren't you grateful for a second chance? Not all of us got that. Some of us would kill for that." But I had no right. Instead, I just asked, "When did you first notice him crying?" "About 2 weeks ago. I woke up middle of the night sometime. Thought I heard a noise or something, so I get up and look down the hall. Dad usually sits in the chair in the living room at night, right where the hall empties out there, so I can see him when I look down the hall. Only he wasn't there. and I hear this noise, like I left a window open and the wind's coming through. So I follow it. Dad's standing in the kitchen, just standing there in the middle of the room, looking up at the ceiling. His arms are out like he's reaching for something. And in the moonlight, I can see he's crying. He's crying, and I didn't even know they could cry. And he never cried once while he was alive, not that I saw. And he's making this sound, this whisper. I got up real close, and he just ignores me like I'm not there, so I can hear. And he's saying, "Maggie, Maggie," over and over, looking up at the wall. Barb's voice had become a thin scratch of sound, the effort to keep it steady, making the veins in her neck rise in cords beneath the skin. I glance up, and Bill stood behind her inside the screen door. He looked as if he might cry himself. He wanted to come out to comfort his wife, but she was not the type of woman who accepted such things, so Bill held his ground. "Maggie was my mother's name," she finished, and finally she turned toward me, a flame in her eyes, a fire of grief like I'd seen in her father's eyes nights before. "How come she didn't come back too, Mr. Richards? She was with him when they died. How come he came back alone?" I didn't know, and I had no words of comfort, because I could feel my own grief overwhelming me in a downable hope and despair. I drove off quickly, leaving her alone on the stoop, watching over the indistinct form of her husband, half hidden by the screen and the shadow indoors. Karen grew fine and strong in all the things a parent wishes for a child. Gwen and I, for the first time, I think, accepted our lot in life, the place we'd ended up. We might not have a life to sing about, but we had Karen, and she was more than compensation. Maybe, we told ourselves, when she's grown, when she's a young woman, and leaving for her own life, we'll think again of adventures in faraway places. For now, we have paradise here. 5 short years. Half a decade of paradise is too cruel. It would have been better. I screamed at night, never to have given us a taste of it at all, to have left us childless and bitter to the end of our days rather than a car, like so many others every day, that it's always others. It's never our own. A car trying to beat a red light, failing, not even close, accelerating to squeeze through before the flow of traffic changed direction, failing. Gwen and Karen pulling into the intersection. They were both belted, strapped in, and secure, as well as protected as they could be. Gwen had become quite frantic about that, had even lobbied for stronger seatbelt laws after Karen was born. You protect your own. Sometimes it's not enough. Gwen lived to her great and utter despair. The car hit the passenger side, Karen's side. The cheap metal crumpled like paper. It drove inward, slamming into Karen, into her side and her head, the window shattering and spraying across her face. They said she never felt a thing. I don't believe them. In my mind's eye, I'm with her, and time slows so that every instant is an endless moment of recognition and fear. The sight out of the corner of our eye of the oncoming car, our mouth opening in a high scream, the door bulging, reaching for us, the glass bending in, gleaming like a bubble before it pops, bursting over us, the long, clawing descent into darkness. 5 short years of heaven before we were cast out. You earned sympathy for the devil. The funeral was well attended, for Karen was a well-loved child in a small sea of black. Garbed children and adults covered the manicured lawn. Gwen stood beside me as still as a stone, her face locked in an impassive gaze into the distance. Bruises marked her cheek and forehead, and when we were alone, I'd see her wince when she walked as the broken ribs ground at her. This was all the damage the crash had caused her physically, and that was her punishment, she had told me one night. We sat huddled in each other's arms, and I'd been unable to stop my own endless torrent of grief and longing. and Gwen had watched in silence, dry-eyed. Shamed and raging, I had screamed at her, accused her of not loving our daughter, of not caring. I don't know how she didn't hate me in that moment. "This is my punishment," she said, touching the green and black stains on her face. "This is God laughing at me. He took my baby, and all he left me was this." In some odd way, it would have been kinder to her if she'd suffered more, been more severely injured, participated more fully in Karen's death. Instead, she'd been shut out entirely, left to live with it, and unable to justify her own pristine condition. I had held her then and asked her forgiveness and cried through the night. And now her eyes were still dry and her mind was far away. I looked at the crowd, seeing faces I knew, those I didn't, all wrinkled in grief and pity as they gazed on her pathetically small casket. And the minister spoke in solemn tones about resurrection and rebirth. My eyes fell on Mitchell. He stood somberly as he always did, and somewhere he had found a dark suit. It was moth-eaten, holed through in several spots, many years out of date and exuding an aura of dusty dinginess. It so perfectly belonged on a zombie that I almost laughed out loud and bit my tongue as my brain leapt into associations. Zombies, resurrection. Dear God, had it never occurred to me before that moment. No one thinks of the dead until it's one of theirs. No one understood. No one could predict who would come back. Would Karen return to us in a few weeks' time? Would we see her little body shuffling blankly around our home, an empty husk, a lifeless candle? Could we stand that? Could we live with our child, 5 years old and no love in her eyes, forever? I don't remember the rest of the service. I never told Gwen of my thoughts, and if similar ideas occurred to her, she never told me. We went about our lives in fear and hope, when it was obvious Karen was not coming back. I sat up all night and cried. I don't know if they were tears of thanks or of despair that I would truly never see my little girl again. The zombie found me weeping in the moonlight, huddled behind the counter in the dark store. He never said a word, of course, never showed any emotion. He just reached out a hand to me, reached down and helped me to my feet. July 18th, the day was always like this, always found me, by its last minutes, crying someplace. But it wasn't usually this bad, this overwhelming. She would have been 12 years old, I thought to myself. If 7 years ago today, Gwen had taken a different route, or the other driver had, or I'd held Gwen for 5 seconds longer at the door before they left, or Karen, just as I'd thought in years past, she'd be 11 today, 10 today, if only. But this year there was Albert, who held his hand down to me and pulled me to my feet from behind the counter. When I looked at him, I could see he was weeping, too. What a pair we made. A middle-aged man and a dead man standing in the night and weeping for our loves. "Is that why you cry, Albert?" I said, brushing away my own tears and sniffling like a schoolboy, not really talking to him, but simply giving voice to my morbid thoughts. "Because you'll never see Maggie again? Like I'll never see my little Karen?" Albert turned away. But there had been something there, something that froze the tears on my face and stopped me suddenly, something between derision and pity, from a zombie. "Albert?" He had disappeared down the rows, and I glanced up and down them in the darkness, trying to find him to know what the look meant. I found him standing between the breakfast cereal and cookies, looking at a spot hidden in the darkness, high on the wall, weeping furiously. "Albert, what are you seeing? Tell me, please." His lips, I could see now as the moon slid through the window, were moving, though no sound escaped from them. I leaned closer, straining with both eyes and ears, trying to decipher the movement of his mouth, and I recalled Barb's story of the day before. It was easy to see after that. "Maggie," he whispered over and over. "Maggie, Maggie, what do you see, Albert? Damn it, tell me." My voice was a desperate whisper. I have to know. And impossibly, he answered me. A zombie, a being that supposedly could not speak, who felt no emotion and did only what he was told, answered me, told me what he saw, what I think they all see. And now I knew why the zombie wept and why all of them, as we would now if we followed them at night or into their private places, wept. Albert just couldn't control it as well as the others, couldn't keep it inside. The pain and despair and longing that sprang from the curse of the zombie, trapped between two worlds and seared into silence. Heaven, he said. I see heaven. I stand in the dark. Albert's not with us anymore. No zombies are. Not after what I learned about them. Not when I know the pain they're in, and yet, so I'm alone in the dark, and the knife's blade glints coolly in the moonlight that falls in the strips of light and darkness through the pulled blinds. I've left a note for Gwen, so she won't be surprised when she comes down to the store. She'll be shocked, angry, disgusted, alone, but she'll know what to expect, lying in the aisle between breakfast cereals and cookies. The best of both worlds. I'll come back, somehow, some way. And so I'll still have Gwen, still have the sight of her that I'd gloried in since the day we met, and when I can bring myself to look with a zombie's sight over the threshold into heaven or whatever you choose to call it, into that place that Albert looked and saw his Maggie, I'll see my Karen, my little girl, and I'll whisper her name at night and weep in solitude. Delving in the Dark by Barbara Mater. Somebody's out there, Raymond. Penelope stood at the screen door of the old New England farmhouse, staring into blue twilight. She drew her worn pink cardigan across her thin chest and folded her arms. It was a cool evening for May. Looks like a bunch of little kids. Her husband at the kitchen table behind her lowered his newspaper. In the pouring rain? On a school night? Raymond propped his reading glasses on top of his sparse gray hair. What are they doing, Mama? She squinted. Half a dozen small dark figures crowded busily into the deepening shadow of the old garage on the far side of the driveway where the lawn sloped down toward the creek 100 yards away. I can't tell. Raymond got up and stood beside her at the door. Where are the binoculars? She thought a moment, smiling to herself. It was always a guess as to where he might have left things. I don't know, Raymond. Up in the bedroom, I think. You go, Mama. You're quicker than I am these days. It was true. But then Penelope thought she'd always been quicker than Raymond in some respects, such as keeping track of things. She found the binoculars upstairs on his dresser and pointed them out the bedroom window. The kids were still there. Penelope recognized the spread legs dance, the swing of small arms and shoulders. They were digging. Why? And more than that, why here? Puzzled, she made her way back down the stairs, pausing on the landing to turn on the light. When she got back to the kitchen, Raymond took the binoculars from her and swung the screen door open for a better view. The door squeaked. Like a school of fish, the small figures straightened up all at once and turned to look at him. Raymond's jaw dropped and he let the door slam shut. In perfect formation, the children ran silently away into the darkness. Where had they gone? Penelope slipped outside. From the end of the porch, she saw them head for the woodlot. A flicker of red among the trees caught her attention. She looked quickly, but saw nothing more except the dark heap of brush that Raymond had thrown in between the trees when he'd cleaned up the yard last fall. Perhaps a cardinal had flown past the porch light. She stepped back into the warmth of the kitchen and nudged Raymond. What do you suppose they were after? Raymond was still staring after them, and she wondered at his slightly shaken look. I don't know. He set the binoculars on top of the refrigerator next to the coleus plant. Buried treasure, he guessed with a nervous chuckle. Remember how Tammy and Bobby always played that? Penelope shut the kitchen door. It was raining for the third night in a row. When our kids were that size, they were in before dark. Do you suppose their parents know? Raymond looked away, then said, probably don't know or care. They may be trailer camp brats. Penelope felt sad for the little diggers. Rain pounded on the roof as the dark gathered in. Raymond kept glancing out the window and shaking his head. Haven't seen a spring this wet since I was a boy. In the morning, it was raining harder. Raymond slept late, as he liked to do in wet weather. But Penelope woke early and hungry. Coffee and toast in hand, she stood at the kitchen door looking out. There were bushel basket-sized holes along the hillside, down toward the apple trees that lined the swollen creek. The sight worried her. It seemed as if by digging all those holes, rudely and pointlessly, in their smooth green lawn, the kids from the trailer camp had made some threat to her and Raymond's safety. What do they want with us? And yet it was a pity if they had no place else to play. No use talking to Raymond about filling in the holes, especially in the rain. His arthritic knees would be bothering him. He got up around noon and sat at the kitchen table. Now listen, Mama. You stay inside today, out of the wet. You know I don't trust the creek when the water's high. Right, I know. She heard those words many times before. She wasn't afraid of a little rain, but she didn't say so. Raymond went down cellar to putter away the afternoon in his workshop. To cheer herself, Penelope baked a big batch of molasses cookies, which left the kitchen warm and spicy smelling. Around 4, when she could create no more chores for herself, she decided to go outside, bundling up in an old pair of jeans and a couple of sweatshirts, plus Raymond's hunting jacket and her garden hat and boots. Penelope went out into the cold rain. She closed the screen door softly, not wanting to worry Raymond, and picked her way down the steps to the soggy lawn. The creek was still rising. Dark water rushed downstream toward the little low bridge on the highway, sweeping over grass along the banks and carrying away fallen branches from the trees. The water coming up onto the lawn looked clear as old window panes rippling over the green blades. She put one finger into it at the edge. Her finger quickly grew numb with cold. Penelope put it in her mouth, as if it had been stung. The creek had made Raymond nervous every spring, since they'd first moved out here to his old boyhood home. Bobby and Tammy, then in grade school, had been warned repeatedly not to play near the water when it was high. But Penelope had watched Raymond staring after them anxiously whenever they went outside. "Yes, it scares me," he told her. "I'm afraid that creek will devour them, Penny. It seems like the water has a will of its own when it gets going like this. My dad used to say there was something alive in it, and he didn't mean fish." Now Bobby and Tammy were safely grown and gone, and after all these years, Penelope sensed that they had formed an uneasy truce with the creek. The holes, lined up about 100 feet back from the water, appeared to be about 3 feet deep and 3 feet wide. They weren't filling up with water. The kids had piled the dirt on the uphill side, so the diverted runoff trickled down into the grass. Clever kids. In the air over the yard hung a good woodsy, loamy smell, like freshly turned forest earth. She marveled how smells could linger in the rain. Penelope tried to count the holes, but after the 10th one, she could not see far enough in the rain to tell how many more there were. She wasn't even sure how far back the row went, since it was just too wet to crawl through the brush by the creek or wade through the long grass and cross the pasture fence. It would have been a big job to dig a row all the way across the old empty pasture, overgrown after several summers without cows. Penelope doubled back up the hill and approached the woodlot, a stone's throw behind the house. The brush pile in there was much larger than she remembered, probably 6 feet high and twice as wide. She wondered when Raymond had enlarged it, and why. Dozens of little oozy footprints in the mud nearby told her that the kids must have found the old shortcut through the lot, the weedy path to the road where the trailer camp was. When she got back to the house, she filled her big stainless steel mixing bowl with molasses cookies and put some plastic wrap over it. Then she set it on the porch, toward the middle, where it wouldn't get wet. If the kids came back, maybe they'd eat the cookies and be grateful enough to stop making holes in the lawn. Her outdoor clothes were soaked, and she felt chilled as soon as she stopped moving around. By the time she had changed into dry clothes and eaten a couple of cookies herself, Raymond came upstairs. "What have you been doing, Penny?" His voice was tight, and she saw him looking at her wet footprints by the door and at his wet jacket on the coat hook behind the washing machine. She looked up. "I went out to look at the holes." "Well, I wish you wouldn't," he scolded. "The Delvers came out. That means a flood, and you know I don't trust that creek out there." Penelope sat down at the table. "Delvers?" She searched his face for clues to the unfamiliar word. Raymond sat opposite her. "That's what my dad used to call them. Delvers. Said they live in the ground." He took a bite of a cookie. "Course, I thought it was just another one of his tall tales, at least. I did till last night. Those kids we saw weren't regular kids, Mama. Dad said they'd been heard of around here ever since his grandfather's time, and maybe before that, though he'd only seen them once, or thought he did. He saw the holes all right. The Delvers didn't show up too often, but when they do, they dig holes. Don't know what they dig 'em for, but they only do it when the creek gets real high." Penelope felt a smile try to climb up onto her face. "Is that supposed to be the truth, Raymond?" she asked softly. "Or is it some kind of fairy tale? Now, did you ever know me to tell fairy tales?" Raymond asked sharply, but he wouldn't look at her. He kept his eyes busy watching his fingers break up a couple of cookies into little pieces. Her smile arrived. "Well, you used to tell Tammy and Bobby tall tales about yourself, about Ichabod Crane and the Headless Horseman." She gave him a knowing look. Raymond's face was pained. "That was just for fun, Mama." "Yes," she answered soothingly, "but it's hard to tell when you're joking." Raymond chased cookie crumbs around on the tablecloth with his finger. Penelope figured his feelings were hurt. While she was still wondering what to think, he asked, "What's for dinner, Mama?" Penelope said about cooking. He'd get over his sulk. Once she was good and busy, Raymond went into the living room. After a few minutes, he called, "Mama, come here and bring the binoculars." She turned the fire down on the way. "Here you are." "It's them, all right." Raymond took the binoculars and stared out into the night. She poked him in the side. "Let me see." He moved over about an inch. She squeezed in beside him at the window. Rain rippled the glass, but she could see that the diggers were there again, indistinct in the last light of the dark day. Raymond kept watching, shifting from foot to foot. Penelope figured his knees were hurting from the damp weather. She squinted into the darkness. The small figures seemed to be all the same size and moved in loose-limbed unison, like a little boy's drill team. "Still looks like kids to me." Raymond scratched his head. "Yeah, maybe so, if you say so." He sounded a bit sarcastic. "But it's funny," Penelope pondered, "how they all look so much alike." "I suppose..." Raymond stared down his nose at her, looking playful and annoyed at the same time. "It's the dirt. Uniform layer of dirt, you see. But none of them had a bath this year. Supper ready?" It was. They went into the kitchen, Raymond set the binoculars firmly on top of the refrigerator, knocking a couple of leaves off the coleus. Penelope wondered why he so badly wanted to convince her that those weren't just kids out there. She wished she could get a look at the children by daylight. She served the food and they ate without conversation. Raymond was dunking a molasses cookie in his coffee when something clanked on the porch, and Penelope heard small feet running away. She smiled to herself. Then there was a rumbling sound and a flash of lightning out in the yard. After the blue-white glare had faded, there was a much smaller flash of red. Red? Had something caught fire? Penelope got up to look, snagging the binoculars on the way. Out on the porch, the cookie bowl was gone. Of the diggers and of the red light and its source, she could see nothing. Raymond, what was that red flash? Lightning, I guess. His voice was still tight, impatient. He joined her at the door and she linked her arm through his. She hoped the kids would make it home all right. Poor things, with no one to care how they came or went. Lightning flashed again, followed by a momentary red glow from the brush pile. It seemed to Penelope that the flash burned an image onto her eyes, a tableau of 6 or 7 small, shaggy, dark figures, all about 4 feet tall, with nondescript tatters for clothing. Raymond grunted and flipped the wall switch, turning on the 200-watt porch light. Little dark figures straightened up all at once like startled guppies and ran off silently in step. Raymond chuckled as he watched them run. "That's right," he said. "Get out of here." They were headed for the woodlot again. Penelope was taken aback by the sight. The more she saw of them, the stranger they looked. Maybe Raymond was right. Maybe she shouldn't doubt him. Delvers. Raymond. What did your father say delvers do beside dig holes? Another pulse of unmistakably red light. Raymond huffed. He didn't say, but I think we're about to find out. Lightning flashed again, and Penelope saw the delvers coming back. This time, not with shovels, but with strangely carved and decorated wooden sticks, long as their little arms. All highly polished and banded with gleaming silver. She marveled. What have they got there? Without answering, Raymond gently detached her hand from his arm and limped stiff-kneed toward the cellar door. Penelope knew he kept his shotgun behind that door. But the delvers didn't come up to the house. They jumped into the holes. One of them turned around and waved his stick at the porch light. A tiny flicker of thin red lightning crackled across the yard with a soft sound like a piece of cellophane being discreetly crumpled. It disappeared into the porch light, which popped loudly and went out. This left the yard in darkness, except for the little square of yellow light from the kitchen that spilled out around Penelope as she stood in shocked silence in the doorway. Raymond came back with the shotgun, and Penelope's heart sank. "Raymond, don't!" But she broke off at the challenge of his level eyes and lifted chin. And because out there in the darkness, she heard a deep, loud growling as of many dogs, and a splashing, sucking stomp of huge feet that shook the ground and rattled the house windows. Something large and heavy was advancing up the hill from the creek. She shivered. A clod of mud crashed through the kitchen window over the washing machine, leaving the red-checked curtains shredded by broken glass and the rain blowing in. Penelope gasped. Raymond stepped in front of her, the gun broken open over his arm. "Get down, Mama." She stepped back a little. Red lights continued to crackle in the yard. A cloud of mud whacked the side of the house. The thermometer outside the broken window fell and shattered, tinkling on the stones below. Raymond's fingers trembled as he leaned forward with the binoculars. Still, he did not close the gun. "What's there, Raymond?" "It's a great, big, wet thing." He swallowed, shuffled nervously on the kitchen floor, but still kept the binoculars trained on the yard. "Shooting rocks and stuff at us and the kids. It's about 7 feet tall, and it's all drippy, and it keeps... Well, you can hear it growling, can't you? Ain't deaf yet, are you? Don't sass me. But she knew he was just trying to cover up his fear. Something struck the side of the house, shaking the wall. Raymond's voice lost its edge. Call the police, Mama. The phone, when she picked it up, was dead. No dial tone. Whatever was out there, they were alone with it. Raymond grunted and turned off the kitchen light so they could see into the night outside. The monster stomped its way up the hill, growling like a power saw. Penelope could now see that it looked like a many-limbed sprawl, an elephantine centipede. It seemed like a nightmare sculpture, constructed of mud and rotten leaves, with rain for blood, its whole being propelled by sonorous anger. Its stench was captured by the damp air, and she gagged at the odor of decay. The little Delvers were still crackling away at the creature with those curiously sculpted and adorned wooden sticks. How do they do that? Penelope whispered. The thing from the creek growled and flailed and stomped and shook the ground, hurling mud and stones at the Delvers, who dodged as best they could. Mud hit the screen door, spattering Penelope's legs and the kitchen floor. Get out of the doorway, Raymond snapped, still not raising the gun. He scowled as if weighing a grave decision. Lightning continued to flash in the sky and to be answered by red flares from the woodlot and tiny branched flickers from the Delver staves. Penelope's hair rose on the back of her neck. Had they set fire to the brush pile? A pretty good trick after 3 nights of rain. Why did they stay out there? Her eyes were getting used to the darkness. She saw the monster raise one thick, dripping limb and throw something at the little beings in the holes. There was a crack and a splat, like the sound of a melon being dropped on stone. For a few seconds, no more red light splashed. Penelope scooted past Raymond out onto the porch. Are you hurt? She called. Poor little things. There was no answer. Raymond burst through the door. The shotgun boomed as he fired into the air. As she watched, more Delvers hurried down from the pasture. It looked like the entire third grade from the central school, at least 100 of them, jogging toward the battleground, taking up positions among the original fighters. They, too, aimed threads of red lightning at the monster, which began to steam and to drop bits of itself on the ground. The creature stopped coming. As the red light hit it over and over, it swiped with a crumbling appendage at what might have been its face. Thunder rumbled, and the sky lit up for a moment. Penelope shivered as the last shreds of doubt left her. The little yellow-eyed faces turned up toward the monster were not those of children. They were, as Raymond had said earlier, dark and shaggy. But they had an aged, weathered look, more of bark and twigs than flesh and blood. Raymond was right about the dirt, but it was just a rough, woodsy dirt. She could smell it now, in spite of the monster's stench. Raymond took fresh aim. Get back now, Mama. She didn't move. The wet thing lifted its arm again and flung a chunk of itself right at her. Stones ripped through the screen, one grazing Penelope's ear. She retreated to the sink, got a piece of paper towel, and wiped blood from her ear. When no more stones flew in, she peeked around the door frame again. The Delvers held their ground. The monster was falling apart. Cut by tiny lightning, hunks of it seemed to break off and tumble into the grass. Like a melting snowman, it threw no new clods. From its dismembered mass, a rank, slimy odor continued to rise. Raymond steadied himself, and the shotgun boomed again. The other barrel. Penelope watched bits of monster fly apart like sopping leaves and clumps of mud, scattering back down the hill to be washed into the creek by the rain. How long, I wonder, Raymond mused, till that thing puts itself back together under the water. His eyes met Penelope's, but she looked away quickly. Never turning back, the little soldiers climbed out of their holes and trotted off toward the woodlot. Raymond drew Penelope back inside. You all right? I guess, she nodded. You?
Yep.
What are they, Raymond? What I said they were. He headed for the cellar to put away the shotgun. Whatever they were, they had put up a real struggle. Were any of them hurt? Were any still out there suffering in the cold? Had they left anything behind? Any clues to help a person know them? She helped herself to Raymond's jacket again, put on her hat and went outside. The brush pile was glowing fiercely now, and by its light Penelope could see that one hole was still occupied by a small body that looked achingly like a sleeping child. Its skull showed a narrow wound oozing dark fluid. She bit her lip, stifling horror, and picked up the little delver. It weighed not more than a soaking wet 8-year-old child, but it was a limp and awkward burden. She could not tell if it was breathing, nor could she guess if it was the kind of thing that ought to be. If you were human, I'd take you to the hospital. But it was not human. She did not know what it was. Hey, she called, starting after the others. What about him? She carried the little creature to the woodlot, maybe 50 steps. She looked for his companions, but didn't see them. The good, clean, earthy smell she had noticed before was strongest of all here. The brush pile was not burning. Something inside it was glowing. A brighter space appeared at one side of the pile, as if a door had opened. She could not see inside, but she could feel dozens of little yellow eyes watching, dozens of child-sized creatures waiting for her next move. She set her burden down, very gently, by the bright spot, and backed away, shielding her eyes from the intensity of the light. Don't forget your friend, she called, her voice hoarse with pity and wonder. Nothing happened for a minute or so. It was pretty cold outside, and she figured there was nothing more that she could do. So she started for the house. A few paces away, Penelope turned around for a last look. The light swelled and faded a bit, but the little body was gone. About the time she reached the corner of the house, there was a low whoosh and whir, followed by a roar of wind and a loud clatter as sticks and brush were strewn over the yard. A faint red glow remained in the woodlot, but she could see that no dark, lumpy pile of brush obscured the horizon between the bare trees. The red light winked out, leaving the night pitch black and quiet. No more running feet, no more growling. She noticed, after a few moments, that the storm had ended, too. In the silence, she heard a familiar sound, the ringing of the empty cookie bowl as it rolled from the woodlot down toward the house.